This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at BFL in Switzerland, and will be your host today. Today, we'll be talking to Christopher Kemp about the new book, Dark and Magical Places, The Neuroscience of Navigation. How the brain helps us to understand and navigate space, and why sometimes it doesn't work the way it should. Inside our heads, we carry around an infinite and endlessly unfolding map of the world. Navigation is one of the most ancient neural abilities we have, older than language. In Dark and Magical Places, Christopher Kemp embarks on a journey to discover the remarkable extent of what our minds can do. Well, Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I was wondering if you could start by reflecting on how has this pandemic affected you and your work?
That's interesting. You know, I wear a couple of different hats professionally. So I am a journalist and a writer, and I'm also a research scientist. And so it's affected my work in quite a few different ways, because I was actually working on the book that we're going to talk about when the pandemic began. And it meant that I had to kind of completely alter the project. I'd had a lot of travel planned where I was going to go and meet with scientists, and suddenly that became completely impossible. So it was a book that was really researched and written in large part on Zoom and FaceTime and through other means. And so that's one way that the pandemic really altered things. And then in my research work, it didn't really alter things a great deal. I mean, there was that initial time in March 2020 when everything seemed to change. And within about 10 days, I was back in the lab because we had research projects ongoing. We had research animals upstairs in our vivarium, and there was really no way to hit too long of a pause on the work that we do. And so, in some real respect, I was very happy to be working where I am, because I think I would have gone crazy if my own personal lockdown had lasted any longer than it did.
And going forwards, do you think you will maintain some of the things that you have developed during this time, perhaps more Zoom calls rather than in-person meetings?
Yeah, I do believe that we will. I mean, it's a real opportunity to try and incorporate some of the big societal changes that have taken place. And, you know, even though it was painful, and we began using some of these technologies because of a pandemic, I think that in some really important ways, some of the changes have been incredibly positive. And so I know that, you know, I've always worked in academic institutions, and so often institutions like mine tend to use your physical presence as a metric of your productivity. And, you know, I don't think that's always a very accurate measure of how engaged you are and how much work you're doing. And so I think that that's changed, and I hope that that continues to be to be altered after the pandemic has ended, if it ever ends. But yeah, I think that and Zoom calls and technology and the ability to have a meeting from home, or to have an email exchange instead of a meeting has been an incredibly positive change.
So you already mentioned that you're both scientists and a journalist, which is quite impressive. So can you tell us a bit more about what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a lab manager for a research group here in Grand Rapids in Michigan, and we study primarily Parkinson's disease. And so my background is in neuroscience and epidemiology, and I'm basically the lab manager sort of acts as a facilitator between the primary investigator who writes all the grants and gets the money, and the people in the lab, like the graduate students and the postdoctoral fellows. And it's my job to sort of keep things going and to get people what they need to get the work done. So that kind of job, and especially working in academia, has always sort of given me the opportunity to try to sort of keep my creative side going, which is my journalism and my writing. And it's always, those two things have always really informed each other, I think, and sort of made me better at both of them.
And how did you get interested in neuroscience?
When I was an undergraduate student, I was doing a degree in biology. I've always been fascinated by biology, the human body, science. And when I was 20 years old, I got to do a year in a lab, and I'd happened to work in a neuroscience lab. And from that moment onwards, I never really looked back. I mean, the brain is just endlessly complicated and fascinating. I don't think we'll ever really manage to solve all of its secrets. And so it's something that, you know, I don't think I could ever see myself working in any other field, really.
And during your career journey, were there any mentors or colleagues that really inspired you and helped you along the way?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the people I work with now in Grand Rapids, I've worked for them and with them for about 12 years now. And I couldn't really imagine working for anybody else. And so the way that they approach work, the way that they sort of that they mentor people and provide an environment that is really conducive to learning and to working together is something that I use in my everyday life.
And what would you say to our younger listeners and early career researchers, perhaps, who would be interested in having this kind of dual career like you do, both in science and in journalism?
Well, I think I would say that I've been incredibly lucky. I've been really fortunate. I do think that that something has to give, really. I mean, speaking personally, for me to work in science and to be a journalist / writer, it meant that I couldn't, I never did a PhD. The furthest I went in my graduate studies was, I have a master's degree in epidemiology. And I think that in order to kind of live that dual life, you know, to have two really separate and distinct parts of my professional life that I try to cultivate, it means that you have to sort of be realistic about things. It would be really hard for me to write as much as I do if I was a PhD, a professor, trying to build a research program and get funded and do all that kind of stuff, if I was also trying to write. And, you know, the same is true of my writing career. I write slowly. I do it for my enjoyment. I don't do it to pay my mortgage. I've been incredibly fortunate that I've managed to gravitate toward subjects that really interest me. And hopefully that comes across on the page when people read my writing. And so, you know, I really think that you've just got one life to live. So it's really important to try to gravitate toward things that interest you and that keep you engaged and enthusiastic.
So one of those things that keep you enthusiastic is the brain, as you mentioned, and your latest book, Dark and Magical Places, The Neuroscience of Navigation, looks right into human brain. So can you tell us how did you come to writing it?
Yeah, actually, it's really a pretty personal story in that, you know, I've written a couple of books before and I write pretty widely about science, particularly about evolution and natural history collections, that kind of thing. And I was kind of between books and I was looking for a subject that had sort of the breadth and the general interest, looking for a new project. And then I realized that, you know, my whole life I've struggled incredibly with navigation. I get lost everywhere. It's something that my wife and I, you know, we talk about all the time because she is a very good navigator and I often will drive past my own house and I'll get lost anywhere. And so kind of in a flash several years ago, I suddenly realized, why am I not looking at that? Why am I not sort of asking myself why there's this huge gulf of a difference between our two abilities? And so as often happens with any of my writing projects, I sort of went straight to Google and Wikipedia and the scientific literature and kind of looked at what was out there. You know, often when you do that, you find that somebody's just written a book and published a book on this subject. But in this particular case, I just felt like it wasn't really very well represented by any book, really. And so that's how it began. So it was, you know, a few years of really trying to understand my brain and my wife's brain and why they function so differently.
You cover a lot of really interesting science throughout. So let's delve into some of it. And can we start with the basics? So what is navigation and how did this arise?
Yeah, so, and that's a really, you know, it's a fundamental question. What is navigation? And I think one of the things that makes it such an interesting subject is that it's not really just one thing. I mean, when you think about navigating, even, you know, from your bedroom to your kitchen in your home, you know, it doesn't have to be a very complicated journey. Even something like that, you have to understand where you currently are, and you have to know where you want to be. You have to have a target destination in mind, and then you have to know how to get there. You have to be able to kind of spatially update the whole time so that you can assess the journey as you make it. And so it's a really, really complicated task that you're asking the brain to do. And I would say that that navigation is one of the most complicated things that we ask our brain to do on a regular basis. And, you know, you asked where it came from, what the origins of navigation are. And I think that that's a very complicated question. That's almost as much philosophy as science. There's a real, I think in neuroscience, there's a push to sort of think of navigation as memory. The two really are the same thing. Without memory, you just cannot have navigation. But, you know, all animals navigate, even stationary animals. Like, you know, if you think of plants and trees, and there's lots of really compelling literature that's been written in the last decade or so on the complexity of a forest, and even forests move. And so navigation on the sort of most fundamental level is what animals need to do in order to get everything they need: food, water, a mate, territory, all those kind of things.
So then, is brain really necessary for navigation or some other organisms, for example, unicellular organisms or bacteria can navigate as well?
Absolutely. That is absolutely true. Yeah. I mean, I think that the way that we humans do it is a little different to how many other animals do it. I mean, I think lots of other animals, bacteria, for instance, or more simpler animals, less developed animals, their kind of navigation is different to ours. Ours is very, you know, we humans have such highly developed brains. So much of it is our prefrontal cortex, our wants and needs and desires and anxieties and hopes. And all of those sort of underpin the way that we as a species navigate. But yeah, it's not necessarily for lower species, it's definitely a less complex task that is being performed. Yeah.
And for many people, when you talk about navigation, we think about migrating birds as well. So are their processes different to mammals and humans?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of research being done on birds' brains, and we're just now starting to understand that they can use the Earth's magnetic field to navigate in ways that we can't. You know, they have different sensory equipment than we do. Other species, mole rats, you know, naked, blind mole rats also use the Earth's magnetic field to navigate. And so, I mean, that's one of the things to remember about navigation is that humans, compared to many other, even mammal species, just aren't very good at it. That's why it's such an important part of our lives. We're very visual as a species. And there are many, you know, when I take my dog for a walk, I remind myself that he's got orders of magnitude more olfactory receptors than I do. And he sees the world visually also like I do, but he smells it in ways that are way more sensitive than I can. And he walks through you know, huge gradients of smell that tell him a lot more than his vision does.
So what are the ways that you study brain processes associated with navigation? As I understand, you cannot have a huge MRI machine with the people who are running in a forest.
That's totally true, yeah. I mean, it's for something that is such an important part of our daily lives, we are very limited in the way that we can study it in the lab. And so there's two main ways. One is that we, and an awful lot of the research that has been done to this point has been done on rats and other lab animals. And, you know, using an experimental animal like that allows researchers to actually listen in to individual cells and understand their activity levels in different situations. So that's one way that we've understood how mammal brains navigate. And then the other way is that people use virtual reality. So you can now put a person in an fMRI machine and then get them to navigate a virtual city instead of a real city. So that's been incredibly informative for researchers.
Oh, that's fascinating with a virtual reality. You can literally put people anywhere, isn't it?
Yep, you can put people in, you know, a very data-rich environment like a city. You can put them in London or San Francisco or anywhere you like, or you can put them in a desert and see how they do without any landmarks at all, or you could put them in the tundra. It's really incredible. And there's been some really good research to show that even though it's not a real environment, that the brain does process a lot of that spatial information in the same way. So yeah, it's really been vital.
I was wondering whether some fictional environments can also make a difference. For example, put people in space and see how they orient.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, I think that the possibilities are endless. If you can imagine it, then you can put someone into that environment. Yeah.
So what are some of the basic mechanisms that help us navigate? For example, what are cells involved?
Yeah, so over the past 40 or 50 years or so, scientists have gradually been identifying these very specific different neurons that perform incredibly important tasks. So one of them, one of the first ones that was discovered really in the 1970s is the place cell, which is found almost exclusively in the hippocampus, which is a brain region involved in learning and memory. And it fires in a really specific way that tells someone where they are. And the way it does this is that, you know, say there's several hundred thousand place cells in someone's brain. For any specific location, a smaller ensemble of them, so a smaller subpopulation of cells, will fire together to say, I am here, I am in this place. And then when you move to a different location, a completely different subpopulation of cells fires together, say 10,000 cells fires together to say that you're in this different place. And, you know, it works in the same way as we can use the alphabet in, you know, numerous different configurations to spell thousands and thousands of words. The place cells fire in these ensembles to denote a location in space. So that's one of the most important ones. I find it sort of mysterious and incredible that those cells are firing away and doing this for us. Then in the 1980s, researchers discovered a completely different type of neuron called the head direction cell, which acts as a kind of internal compass that that fires in a very specific way depending on where our head is pointed. And then most recently, in the past 10 years or so, researchers discovered the grid cell, which, again, a completely different neuron, fires in a very orderly way to kind of put a grid, if you like, over our entire environment as we walk through it. And when you think about it, these are all really important aspects of any map that we would need. We'd need to know where we were, what direction we were pointing in, and how far or close we were to other parts, other, you know, aspects of that environment. And so together, these cells are always firing away to help us build what we think of as a cognitive map, which is kind of an internal representation of our environment that is produced in the hippocampus. And that's, those are really the underpinnings of the human navigation system.
And then on the brain networks level, so how does the brain do it? For example, we don't know all of our environments all the time, but we still might be able to navigate through them. So even though the memory is involved, we don't really memorize every environment or...
Well, that's true. I mean, what you're asking is still in large part unknown, how we actually do that. I mean, I think that that's that work continues, and I think it will for a long time. In addition to these really specialized neurons that we have, we also have very specialized parts of our cortical area of our brain. The cortex is the sort of surface layer of neurons on the brain surface, and the way that the brain helps us perceive our world and make sense of it is that it kind of parcels out different parts of understanding the world to different regions of the brain's surface. So a good example would be facial recognition, for instance. If you put someone in an fMRI machine and show them an image of a tree, there's a part of the brain that does not activate. But if you show them an image of a face, it does activate. It's called the fusiform face area. It's basically designed just to recognize faces. And there are people who have face blindness, prosopagnosia, for whom that part of their brain does not work. And so we also have several different regions of the brain surface that help us to perceive and understand space too. And, you know, so they're taking the information that these place cells, grid cells, and head direction cells manufacture, and they're helping us to interpret our environment and to kind of understand really important information about a scene, an environment, help us to understand our way through it and to aggregate information and to navigate our surroundings.
So what do we know about navigation of early hominin cultures, and was it different to navigation of people nowadays?
It's a good question. A lot of that work is necessarily speculative, because we can only know so much about, say, I write in the book about the difference between Neanderthals and early humans. And the best that we have when we're thinking about Neanderthals and how they navigate is we have their craniums, we have the remains of their skulls. And so scientists can take what's known as an endocast, which is kind of they basically use the cranium as a mold. And then what you get back is sort of a rough approximation of the shape of the brain that once sat in that cranium. And, you know, from those remains, we know that Neanderthal brains were quite different in shape to early human brains. We know that Neanderthals had really kind of flattened skulls, and that somewhere in the, you know, relatively recent history, between 100,000 and 60,000 years ago, early humans seemed to have this very rapid expansion of part of our brain that gave us sort of much more classically modern human shape of a rounded parietal lobe, that the top part of our brain became much more sort of rounded and less flattened. And that's really important, because that parietal lobe is where a lot of those brain regions can be found that help us to sort of understand our place in the environment and to be able to imagine ourselves in another place. Those are really important parts of navigation. And, you know, it's like I say, it's quite speculative, but there are researchers who think that that sudden expansion of the brain that made us sort of quintessentially modern human, if you like to think of it that way, is what may have given us an advantage over Neanderthals. And it's what might have allowed us to sort of radiate out quite rapidly from Africa like we did and colonize the entire planet, which is something that the Neanderthals didn't do. They lived in a really pretty circumscribed territory, a kind of band of territory that they didn't really leave once they got there. And so, yeah, it's a really interesting concept to think that that the brain changes that sort of made us human are also the changes that allowed us to navigate in the way that we do.
And now to a more unsettling question then, because nowadays we all use GPS, and many of us have heard that because we use GPS, our navigation skills might be disappearing. Is this true?
Yeah. I mean, in short, I think it really is. It really is true. Yeah. It's interesting. You know, the brain is really endlessly flexible and it can do such incredible things, but we have to use it. And if we stop using it, then it's very much a case of, you know, it's use it or lose it, if you like. And so, you know, one of the most interesting things about GPS is that it's pretty ubiquitous now. We all have a GPS device in our pockets, on our phones, on any new car that comes off the lot. And there was not a great deal of research done on GPS and its effects on the brain before we got to this point. I think that's one of the most interesting things. We just sort of let it in. And one thing that we definitely do know is that if you put someone in an fMRI scanner and you get them to navigate a virtual environment, all of these brain regions that we've talked about, the hippocampus particularly, is very activated by navigating. But if you put someone in an fMRI scanner and you get them to go through a virtual environment by telling them exactly where to go, you know, turn left, turn right, go straight for a mile, like you do with a GPS, then those brain regions are completely silent. They're just not activated in the same way. And so those are the brain structures that allow us to form this cognitive map. And so there's some very real evidence forming that for people who rely heavily on GPS to navigate, they're just not building these maps. And that's important because, you know, navigation is really what you do when you suddenly see construction up ahead and you have to take an unplanned detour. You know, that's when you're accessing your cognitive map and making sudden flexible decisions on the fly. And you can't do that if you haven't formed a map. And so, the sort of ubiquity of GPS is actually it's quite concerning, and it's the future.
So, what are some of the brain disorders that can affect people's abilities to navigate?
Well, there are many. I think the one disorder that is most closely linked to navigation is Alzheimer's disease. And, you know, one of the first symptoms, obviously people always think of Alzheimer's disease as, you know, dementia, forgetfulness, loss of self. But by far one of the very first symptoms is sort of impacting the spatial abilities. And so, and that's because some of them, when Alzheimer's disease is first starting to develop, are in a brain region called the entorhinal cortex, which is where some place cells are and it's where grid cells are. And that means that that's really one of the very first symptoms. But there are other illnesses. Particularly, in the book, I list some situations where if somebody has a brain bleed in a brain region that is particularly important to sort of aggregating spatial information, like the retrosplenial cortex, then, you know, there's a case I write about. It was a Japanese taxi driver, and he was out. He just finished a shift. He had a small brain bleed. Unbeknownst to him, he didn't know what was happening. But suddenly, even though he could see the buildings and he knew where he was, he couldn't take that information and access his cognitive map and work out how to get home. And so he had to phone his wife up and tell her where he was, and she had to guide him home. There's all, you know, for a system like the navigation system that relies on so many different brain regions sort of communicating with one another and passing information back and forth, it's quite a fragile system, because if any one of those components of it stops functioning properly, then you're going to struggle to navigate.
So the loss of navigation then can be a very valuable symptom in order to really recognize that something is wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's a really interesting smartphone app called See Hero Quest, and I write about it quite a bit in the book, because on the face of it, it just looks like a fun sort of game to play on your phone. It's you pilot a little boat around a bunch of islands, and it's, you know, you try to remember certain routes, and you're looking for monsters, and it's a fun game to play. But it was actually originally designed to try to devise an early detection, if you like, an early diagnostic tool for Alzheimer's disease. And that's what people, you know, I work in Parkinson's disease, and a lot of people who are studying neurodegenerative disorders are trying to find diagnostic tools that give us the ability to recognize that somebody has one of these disorders as early as possible, because that's when you're going to have the best chance of trying to modify the disease progression and to, you know, try to head it off at the pass, if that was at all possible, is to get to it as early as possible. So, yeah, so we have things like See Hero Quest, and as a result, that particular app has allowed researchers to really sort of get at some of these spatial differences between people and why some people are good at navigating and some people are less good at it.
And then on the opposite side, are there any super navigators?
Yeah, there definitely are. I mean, one of the reasons I decided to write the book is that my wife is a super navigator. I mean, she's able to perform feats of navigation that I consider almost supernatural. I mean, I just am often in awe of her abilities. And, you know, spatial abilities in general have a huge range across individuals. And that's one of the things that was so interesting to me. I mean, you take other cognitive domains like attention or executive function, and they don't have the same range of ability that spatial abilities do. And so, you know, generally you have a lot of people who are sort of okay, and then you have some people who are just absolutely terrible, lost all the time. And then you do have this small segment of the population that is incredible at it.
And one would imagine that having really good spatial navigation would be useful in the Navy, for example, or in the forestry work.
I'm sure it would be. You know, it's there are definitely some professions that really use their spatial abilities well. Yeah, absolutely.
So what are some of the questions that still keep you up at night?
Well, I think that one of the questions that will probably always be with me is, how do you get better? How do you get better at navigating? And, you know, the thing that the one question that I really had at the start of this project was, my wife would always say that I just wasn't paying attention. I wasn't paying enough attention to where I was and to where I was going. And I always pushed against that. I say in the book that I feel like that's a little like telling someone who's colorblind that if they just stared at the grass long enough, they would understand that it was green. I don't like to tell her that she's right, but I do think that that she has a point. You know, I think that I have a couple of sections at the back of the book where I have some tips about how to become a better navigator, and it's probably no surprise to anyone that one of the most important tips is to pay attention. You know, we can only form a cognitive map, and we can only sort of understand where we are and process space if we're really kind of locked into it and looking around and understanding where we are, looking for landmarks, trying to even, you know, think of where the sun is in the sky. I mean, these are all sources of really important spatial information. And I think that I'm just not very good, at it, but I think everybody can get a little better. And so that's one of the things that really sticks with me is, can I improve? Can I continue to improve? And sometimes that takes a little bit of bravery. That takes, for me, you know, after I've talked about just how impactful GPS devices are, I rely on one almost completely because I'm so bad at navigating. But then you get to a certain point and you think that it might be a little of a chicken and egg situation, and I will never improve if I'm not willing to switch off the device and get lost a few times.
And now thinking about the bigger picture, what would be key implications of exploring our brain and this field of navigation for our society? Perhaps getting children interested in navigation a bit earlier or teaching them some of the skills?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I mean, I think I come at it from two different directions. One is that yes, it's definitely important to expose kids to different environments and to allow them to be independent and to sort of explore by themselves. I mean, that's how they really generate some of these skill sets, and it's really important to allow them to do that. So that's one side, and that's sort of where you were coming from. But I also think that one thing this project has really allowed me to do is kind of accept that my navigation skills, my spatial abilities, are a product of my brain and how it works, and that is part of who I am. And to sort of accept that and to love that about myself, and to know that while there's a little bit of an ability to sort of modulate things slightly to improve somewhat, that, you know, me not being very good at that is probably just part of how my brain functions. And, you know, some people are really good at playing musical instruments, and some people are good at math, and, you know, sometimes that even goes into sort of the emotional spectrum. So some people are more empathetic, some people are more anxious. And so I just I think another part of it is to sort of accept people as they are. We have the term nowadays, sort of neurotypical and neurodivergent. And I think everybody's a little neurodivergent one way or another. So to just sort of accept people where you find them.
What discoveries along your journey to writing your book, Dark and Magical Places, surprised you the most?
I think that last one, you know, I write in the book about a young researcher called Nico Dosenbach. And he basically formed what he called the Midnight Scan Club, he was really interested in looking at individual differences in brains. And so he basically got a group of his young doctor friends together, and at midnight, when the scanners, you know, the brain scanning equipment was not being used, they would sort of get time in the equipment at a sort of bargain price. And so they would lie in the fMRI scanners, and they would have these super high resolution brain scans taken. And, you know, they learned, and they've written several papers on this, but they've basically shown that everyone's brain is incredibly different. You know, anyone in the science field has grown very used to seeing scientific papers where they show sort of a grainy image from a scanner, and there'll be a little red dot saying, you know, this is where, I don't know, mathematical ability can be found, or this is where spatial ability is, or, you know, a host of any other cognitive abilities can be found in different places in the brain. But what they found is that everyone's brain is incredibly different. And, you know, the brain is organized in this way. It's called a connectome. It's how all the different brain regions are connected to one another. And that the connectome is not always the same in different people. And so that this research is kind of relatively new and ongoing, and it really is needed. And I'm not sure if enough research has really been done on this to show that everybody is really incredibly different. And that's the thing that sort of surprised me the most. You think, I always thought that brains are sort of organized in a kind of universal way, and that everyone's brain is relatively similar, but that just is not the case.
And have you ever done a labyrinth or a maze where you have to navigate through the bushes? And how good are you?
I am terrible. I'm terrible at that. I write in the book about, I mean, one thing that's really interesting about this is that it takes a little bit of age, I think, and perspective to really understand that there's something that you're not good at. And so I think I only really started to come to terms with my navigational failures when I hit about 40. And that's when you start to really just sort of accept who you are, I think. And until then, I just thought everybody was about the same. But I remember going to a mirror maze in Chicago. And it's a maze that's made entire, all the walls are mirrored. And so everything is reflecting and making new reflections. And I found it borderline terrifying. And I got lost in there for a while, and I ended up having to rely on one to come and find me. And I'm glad he did, because otherwise I would probably still be in the mirror maze. But it's, that is something that I have kind of learned to accept, that that's, something that I just really feel like I can't do. I can't do labyrinths or mazes or anything like that, especially because it's just not fun for me. I mean, my kids love it. They love that kind of thing. But for me, it just fills me with anxiety.
Sounds that they really need Google Maps for the mirror mazes.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. So can you tell us, what are you currently working on and what will be your next project?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm lucky in that, but as I said at the start, I have a day job, which is in a research lab. And so on any given day, I'm usually sectioning rat brains and staining them for different things and looking at them under a microscope. And that's what I was doing about an hour ago, and it's what I'll continue to do. In my writing life, I'm very lucky that I sort of wait until some idea or some project kind of sneaks up on me and jumps on me. And when it does, it normally sort of consumes me for a couple of years. And so I'm waiting for that next thing to come and find me.
What would be the best place for our listeners to find more information about your work and also your book?
I have a website, and I'm also very findable on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. And I do love hearing from people. I love getting feedback. And I think that really my writing is an attempt to start a conversation with someone. So I'm always happy to hear from people who want to talk about what they find there.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today and helping us navigate this complex subject. Sorry for the pun.
No, I appreciate the pun very much, and really appreciate the chance to have a chat too.